Listen, everybody, we all know that real estate is the most proven way to build wealth. But why isn't everyone wealthy from real estate then? It's hard to know where to start, and most of the education out there is just complete trash, and you end up investing your money on a series of courses instead of in real estate. That's not how this podcast works. We give you the blueprint to successful real estate investing and bring on guests actually willing to share their secrets. I started my real estate investing journey as a freshman in college when I bought my first duplex and have been in the trenches doing deals ever since. And today, I now own hundreds of millions of dollars of investment property. On this podcast, you will learn what you actually need to know to be a successful active or passive real estate investor. And we'll offer our takes on what's happening today so you can navigate this market and build wealth. I'm Drew Brenneman, and this is the Brenneman Blueprint.
All right. Dan Breezy, co-founder of Granite Towers Equity Group, is on the show today. Welcome, Dan.
Hey, Drew. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, glad to have you here today. I think I had heard you a long time ago, actually, on a different podcast because your story is very easy to remember. So, happy to have you here today. I know you were a professional snowboarder for over 10 years. I mean, why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, you bet. I grew up in a small town in central Minnesota, and I heard from my parents over and over again, do what you love, do what you love, do what you love. We didn't do what we love. You should chase something. You follow your passion. So at a pretty young age, I started thinking about what I really enjoyed doing, and kind of randomly, a snowboard came into my life from my cousin. And, you know, the day it showed up, it was just a cool thing. It was this new way of, instead of sledding down the hill like we do in Minnesota, we'd stand on the board and you could hit jumps and, you know, had just more freedom to turn. So after doing that for, you know, a few years, just kind of as pleasure, I ended up getting better and better and finally got a little better than my brother and started going to contests, local contests, and started to do decent at these contests. And I just really loved doing it. And after probably, you know, 3 to 5 years of first finding a snowboard to having this slight progression into local contest, I realized there were professional snowboarders in the world, and I just decided I wanted to try to be a professional snowboarder. And by about the age of a freshman or sophomore in high school, I pretty much was committed to making the snowboarding career happen, or, you know, die trying. I mean, I was all in. So for the next 5-6 years after kind of making that decision, I would just snowboard every day and work at night. And I moved to Salt Lake City after I graduated from high school, ended up being there for 4 years, working odd jobs. And after being there for 4 years, I'm a good friend was like, you're good. You should go to the Aspen Open and compete. And at the time I didn't have any money to, you know, go from Salt Lake to Aspen. So he drove me there and he paid for my entry fee and he paid for the hotel and stuff. And that contest, there were 275 kids in it, and I ended up winning that contest. And that was kind of the beginning of the brands that I was riding for. To say, hey, this kid's actually pretty damn good and he's young, he's hungry. Let's start bringing him around to more events. And I went to more and more events. I ended up signing a bunch of contracts in a couple year period with a few different brands. Biggest brands I rode for, like GoPro and Rockstar and Volcom. Ended up riding Capita Snowboards and Union Bindings and was on those brands for almost 15 years. And, you know, midway through my career, and the highlights was I ended up getting 2X Games gold medals and 2 silver medals for an event called Real Snow. So it was a real dream come true. But at the same time, I got scared because I could see the writing on the wall. It was going to end. And, you know, that scared me.
Yeah, professional sports, there's always somebody younger and faster coming up behind you. So, or I guess in this can be in the air longer and do a little more. But yeah, that's what kind of hours then, I guess, once you really committed to it. I mean, it was, you moved to Salt Lake City. So then where were you normally riding then?
Yeah.
Do the local resorts or up to Park City? Or
when I was at home in Salt Lake, I would ride at Brighton and Park City and Snowbird, and we would film throughout all of Salt Lake City. But we would go on film trips constantly throughout the winter, and we'd travel all over the world. We'd go to Europe, we'd go to Alaska, Canada. In the summer, we'd go down to Argentina and New Zealand as winter down there in the Southern Hemisphere. So it would really be us just chasing the snow. You know, you'd learn about a storm coming in and you would you'd head to that storm and film with a crew of 3 to 5 snowboarders and filmers. And then once the snow was bad, you'd fly to the next zone. We'd go to Japan, and it was cool. It was constantly moving around.
Yeah. And so then what are some things you learned then? I mean, being really at like the top of your, such a competitive profession. And, what were some things that you learned, I guess, you know, yourself competing and then maybe from other competitors that applies to, you know, your life today as a real estate investor?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think grit and uncertainty of where you're going, clarity of what your goal looks like or the outcome you're looking to create. And, you know, that could be also said with desire. You know, what kind of desire do you have? I've found in my life, when I have a strong desire, the action is easy. You know, when you have a burning desire to do something like I did when I was in high school, I didn't want to be in high school. I wanted to be snowboarding. So school was really hard for me to pay attention and be there when my mind was focused on snowboarding and wanting to be snowboarding. So I ended up, you know, once you have that sort of desire, it just feels so good to do the act, what you're doing. So snowboarding was just fun. It was just pleasurable. And I'd say the same thing with real estate is if you can find and get into something where you love doing it and you love the process, you know, and yeah, the outcomes can be great and there are little moments of celebration, but if you can get to a point where you're having so much fun in the process and you have a clear goal and some grit and stick-to-itiveness, you can create monumental things. I mean, there's nothing you can't create. That's how it's been for me, at least from my perspective.
Yeah. That's a great lesson, Dan. And that's something I've like learned over the years myself. So yeah, glad you're able to share that. Cause yeah, of course, even you think about snowboarding, like I didn't ask you, like, were you working on the weekends? Like, you know, of course you got to ride every day if you're going to be at that level. So
yeah.
You know, but yeah. You loved it.
Yeah, you bet. Yeah. I mean, gosh, that would happen in Salt Lake. I can remember a 4-year period where it was pretty much get up and snowboard until it was dark, go to the gym, work at my, you know, I bus tables at either Payway or TGI Fridays, or I worked at Red Lobster and Blockbuster a couple different years. And then after that, we might go film at night. Like the crew would go out with lights and generators and we'd film at nighttime, get the footage, hit the hay and do it all over again. And you were just on repeat and it was an absolute obsession all day long, every day towards this one goal. It was fun.
Yeah, that's incredible. And then I guess, how did you get started in real estate then? So at some point you found your way into the real estate world.
Yeah, I got scared. Like I was, at the end of my career, I got to know, when I moved to Salt Lake City, I got to know some of these guys who were my childhood heroes. They became my friends. And, you know, the end of their career, I saw it firsthand, real time. And it was, yeah, sad. It was scary. You know, they'd lose their home or their cars, or there'd be divorce or drug addiction, or even suicide. And, you know, when I saw that, I just like, there's got to be something else that I could be looking forward to. Because with most athletes, and I, you know, when I interview athletes, I hear it all the time, is it's your identity. It's who you are. You know, think about a young kid from Minnesota from the age of 13 to 32, where that's all I was. That's all I thought of myself was as a snowboarder. That's who I am. And then all of a sudden that athletic career leaves and now who are you? Now you're nobody. Now, what value do you bring? Well, that's obviously not true, but that's how it may feel. And that's how it felt for a while. So I started to also make decent money as a snowboarder, and the tax bill was steep. So that was another pain point where I'm like, hey, what can I do with the money I'm making to get it to start to pay me money? And, you know, how can I create cash flow and create passive income and get a tax deduction and reduce on my tax bill? So it was those things. And I started reading books and devouring into books and just self-education. Podcasts weren't really around at the time, but I was just reading a bunch of books and getting after it that way. And I would go to seminars as well. I'd fly to seminars. And then I'd always take action with what the book said. I wouldn't just read the book and then chuck it on the shelf and read another book. There would always be action items, the things to do from the book. And I would definitely take strict action based on those books. And then I bought a duplex when I was, I think it was 2012. I bought my first property, you know, similar to your story, Drew, where I had some money saved up, read a few books, did some underwriting, found cash flow, found appreciation, and kind of went for it. And after did that and put a third party manager in place and started to see the success of the loan pay down, the depreciation, the cash flow of appreciation, then I bought a 9-unit property. And after I bought a 9-unit property and saw that, and I bought a 24-unit property, and it just kept going.
Yeah. And I mean, and that's the way to start. I always say, you know, where you don't need to overcomplicate it. You know, you buy something small with your own money. I mean, you learn more, I bet, buying the duplex than probably all the books you read. And then you work your way up where now you're doing bigger deals of a couple thousand units, but it doesn't start out that way usually.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah. Take baby steps and you'll learn a lot and keep, you know, getting those battle wounds and step on them and learn the lesson and improve and just keep going.
Yeah. And even though I said the books may not have been as important as the action taking, was there a book in particular, one or two, that really made kind of like a bigger leap in terms of your knowledge or any come to mind?
Yeah, I really like the way Rich Dad Poor or Robert Kiyosaki writes his books. They're really simple and easy to understand. It's not super complex. So all of his books, I read pretty much all of them. Obviously, Rich Dad Poor Dad's the popular one, but he also wrote a book, Retire Young, Retire Rich, where he talked about the difference between a liability and an asset. And I never understood what that was until reading that book. I also came across a book called Tax-Free Wealth by Tom Wheelwright, and then Ken McElroy had a couple books. You know, those were really the foundation for sparking my interest and in realizing there was another way to create income other than just working for money.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, and I feel the same way with the Robert Kiyosaki books. I remember for me reading the Cashflow Quadrant book, which, you know, in hindsight, so simple, where there's the four ways to make money, but I never had thought of it that way or had it explained that way. And actually my son is six and he wanted to watch TV or do something where I like was going to put a little bit of work before the reward. And I explained to him the four ways to make money using that quadrant. Cause it's simple enough where, I mean, I think he understood it. And he knows what I do for work. So he knows that I'm an investor and all that, but nice. Then how did you make the transition then into bigger deals? Cause just to bring it current day, and correct me if I got the wrong numbers, but you have like about 300 million of property, 2,100 apartment units. I mean, so at some point you made a big jump.
Yeah. We have about 2,900 under management as of today. Over the last year, we bought about 1,000 doors. But yeah, after buying that 24 unit deal, I had a really good friend who was working on buying single family homes, and he had a goal of like buying 100 single family homes or something. It was kind of a big goal, and I was impressed by it. And he came up to visit us here in Washington, and I was like, hey, you should consider forgetting buying the single family homes. Let's buy a 28 unit apartment together that I'm looking at. And he got into it with me and one other friend, and we ended up buying that apartment, and it ended up doing, you know, real well in the beginning there. So we, as we were continuing to learn from that deal, we ended up going to a seminar, but it was a training in Dallas where we ended up working with somebody. I went to many seminars throughout prior to this, you know, Real Estate Guys and some of the Rich Dad stuff. And there's a lot of seminars you can go to on real estate, but there was one gentleman that we really thought had a good understanding of some of the foundation, the basics, and went through that training with him and still work with him. His name is Brad Sumrock. So he's, you know, he's a known guy. And obviously if you know of him, there's some deals in the group that aren't doing the best right now. And there's always going to be that in a market like real estate investing. So that group really helped us immensely. And, I can't say enough about it. You know, I would say one of a group of his students that have really excelled and just worked hard and kept our nose to the grindstone. And it doesn't mean it's always been easy, and it doesn't mean we've had every deal go perfect by any means, but that way of thinking and that mentorship program really was invaluable.
Yeah. And then from what I know about Brad's, you know, people have gone through his programs, and there's like a built-in sort of like team of people you can partner with. Some people, they just want to invest money. Some they want to, you know, work on the deal with you and partner up. I would assume that helped as well as the education.
Yeah, immensely. They have some really great coaches, and you know, these coaches are there to help protect you and help educate you. And so we leaned on them heavily and still do at times. You know, we're looking at a new deal and we'll have a couple of those coaches that we know really well take a look at us and say, hey, kill this deal for us. What are we missing? You know, give us some feedback. What concerns you? And then, yeah, there are folks in the group that, you know, maybe don't want to be asset managers or they don't want to go find the deal, but they have access to capital and they want to be a smaller role as an asset manager, you know, being on the weekly calls and just overseeing the big, big decisions, you know? So there's synergy amongst these groups for sure with the right people. It does take time. It does take a lot of effort, right? To go in and fly in month after month and meet people and get to know them. But you know, if you know what you're going for and you have a desire that's strong enough, it should be fun. And it has been.
Yeah. And then for the bulk of then the deals you guys have bought, it's where it's you've partnered up with the people from the Sumrock group, or it's wasn't sure on those 3,000 units, roughly how many of those you guys were the sole GP on, how you guys had set up the deals.
Yep. All the deals we're buying now were the lead GPs. So if we're buying something, generally we'll have co-GPs come along with us to assist in different roles throughout the business. Our capital sourcing equity, I'd say 50% has come from within the group, 50% has come from without, just networking at other events and, you know, referrals from current investors, or I don't even know where it comes from. It just comes. Our podcast is coming from, you know, there's just different outlets you meet people at. And so that's the structure now is, you know, we find the deals, we'll put the team together, we'll work with a pretty small select group of co-general partners who we've done multiple deals with. And, you know, as long as there's synergy and we have a great asset, it seems to be relatively easy to put deals together. A little more difficult now in the last 12 months than it was prior to that, but still totally doable. And really at a great time in the market. If you're here right now and you know what you're doing, I think you're a lucky investor. And if you've got a general partner, you know, like, and trust, this would be a time to, I think, really get after it and double down on what you're doing over these next 2-3 years.
Let's dive into that a little more. So then I guess from that statement, you think now is a good time to buy?
Yeah, my take is if you know what you're doing, right? I mean, you got to still know what you're doing. You don't just go buy anything. You know how to underwrite a deal, you know, realistically based off of real rent growth, if there is any, and real expense growth, you know, understanding where taxes and insurance have been and where they're going. You have a good understanding of that and you understand a submarket and you could find a deal that maybe is just, you know, has deferred maintenance from a tired ownership group, or it just didn't push rents because they're happy with 100% occupancy, or there's a specific demographic you can target that you have history with and you can say, hey, I know on our 3 deals over here, this is how they performed, or these 5 have performed this way. It's very likely to perform that way again. And you can put fixed debt on it for 5, 7, or 10 years and you're in a cash flow position. I think it'll be difficult with a great asset management team to lose money on those deals right now. And I think it'll be very likely. I think you got a lot of wind at your sails that you're going to get cap rate compression sometime over the next 3 to 5 years, just due to what interest rates have done thus far. I don't think inflation is going away tomorrow. I don't think you're going to see interest rates just slam home quickly. And I don't know how much they'll come down, but I do think that where you are coming at this basis of buying per door with the things I just described, you're in a likely, very, very likely place to do well.
Yeah. It's a very interesting time too, where there's not as many deals happening and a lot of investors are hesitant to invest, but it's interesting. Those same people that are, many of them that are hesitant now, they weren't hesitant 3 years ago when prices were, you know, depending on what kind of property, 10 to 30% higher. So that just on that level, it's like, it doesn't make sense. Like, why wouldn't you be buying now? Obviously it's a different, the numbers are different. Interest rates are higher and depends where you're at. Rents, you know, probably dropped, but it's not, you know, so if you just break it down to the simplest level, it's like you liked it, you know, 25% higher. Like, why would you not be loading up now?
Yeah. You know, the line that just is so clear, I've never seen it more clearly in my life than now, is Warren Buffett, when he says, when people are greedy, be fearful. And when people are fearful, be greedy. And it's so apparent, so clear to look back and see exactly what he's saying, exactly what he's saying in the multifamily market is back in 2021 and early 2022, when people were about as greedy as I've ever seen, fear should have been high. And now you've got fear because they're experiencing the pain of 2 years ago. And now they're in a place where they're terrified or not investing anymore. Now you got it. Now it's switched to go back to being greedy. So I think cycles, there's one thing I've learned in only investing in 2012 to now. And I would say this would be my first real recession. You know, I got lucky coming in 2012, things bottomed and were pretty much uphill until this real estate recession. And they may not be calling it a real estate recession, but I can see quarters after quarter, price reductions come down. We're in a multifamily real estate recession. I don't care what anyone says, I can see it. And so with that being the case, the lessons you learn is that cycles are the most powerful thing. And you have got to understand about where you are in a real estate cycle. And if you can get that data, and there's many books on cycles and they're fantastic. I love reading about history and cycles. And if you get clarity on where you are in that cycle, now you have a better picture of what's likely coming in the future and what kind of debt you might want to use to ride the cycle. And, you know, we saw late 21, all 21, maybe even part of 2020 after COVID being late in the cycle and it peaking, folks got into a flipping game of real estate. You know, like we're in and we're out in 12 months and we just doubled your money. That's not how real estate flows until it's the end of a cycle, like it is. And then it pops and then the music stops and now you see who's swimming with their pants down. So, you know, I think that looking back, that's the piece that is the most powerful thing is understand about where you are in the cycle. And it's never going to be exact, right? It's not the same thing that resets the cycle, but for whatever reason, whatever the rhythm is, it resets at about a certain amount of time and in a certain way, and just be prepared that it's coming. And you're not going to buy at the very bottom. You're not going to probably sell perfectly at the very top, but if you have an idea of where you are in there, it'll insulate you from the big pain.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And then I think what markets are you active in?
Yeah, we are active in Dallas, Fort Worth, and Nashville, Tennessee. Currently, we did buy up in Minnesota where Mike and I grew up and where Mike still lives. We have one asset that is still up in Minnesota. It's just strong performing asset outside of major metropolitan Minneapolis area that's just doing phenomenal with fixed debt. So we'll keep that one. But now we're only looking in Dallas and Nashville.
And then how are you underwriting deals in both those markets today? I know you mentioned not a lot of rent growth and then real expense growth. So what does that actually look like? Maybe just throw some numbers on it, like percentages or how you do it.
Yeah. I can't say exactly percentages, you know, this is, we'll probably use a 2% rent growth if we feel like the data is there. But really what I really love when we find an asset that speaks to us is, you know, I hear a lot of people saying like rent growth is flat nationwide this whole year. And it's like, okay, that's data for nationwide data. I don't care about the nationwide data. I care about a submarket. I care about what is happening in a small part of town of Dallas, right? That's your data point. And what I really like is when you can find something in a submarket, let's say of deals for sale, and you go and shop five or six of the competitors, and you can verify with your own eyes that either your product, people, or price is completely off kilter. And there's something that we can do relatively simple that can solve one or all of those three things. And when you shop the submarket, now you're going to be able to see what's true, what's accurate, what's really going on. And, you know, a great part is it's you get a deal where someone hasn't been moving rents and the submarket has, and you're $150, $250 bucks low, and it is same exact product, same exact location, but they haven't done anything. So you can underwrite that more certainly than future rent growth right now. But I'd say 2-3% is probably the most, you know, we would ever use for the next 2 or 3 years until we see something significantly changing. We will use CoStar and ALN to give us what they project. But really, it's our real time data on the ground of how do we compare. All we're looking to do is take an asset and move the needle to match what the competitors are doing. And if we can beat them, great. But is there a way to match what the submarket has already done by finding something that isn't being operated well?
And so most of the deals, it's primarily then just a loss to lease play, or are you guys doing renovations too? Or
yeah, it's a combination, loss to lease play and at times renovations. The last few deals we bought has had probably $7,000 to $15,000 per door of CapEx. They're facelift things, you know, it's nothing major. It's generally interior upgrades, you know, $7,000 to $10,000 there, and then we'll paint the exterior, upgrade the pools, upgrade some amenities, do some landscape work, parking lot work, stuff like that.
And then what size deals are these approximately?
Our sweet spot is, you know, 150 to 350 units are in that $10 to $30 million price point range.
Okay, nice. And then why did you guys pick that range?
Well, I would even say maybe right now we'd probably be more in that $12 to $20 million range. And the reason it's changed for us is the way we raise capital is it's all within 60 days. So like we'll have zero money put together. We'll go out, we'll find a deal. We'll agree to the price, we'll put it under contract, and then we'll bring it to our investors. And with the way the market is right now and it being more difficult to raise equity, you know, you want to be in a position where you have certainty of closing. We just raised $16.5 million on a deal that closed in December, and it was challenging, you know. And you know, for us it's like, hey, why not just get base hits on a deal that's a little bit smaller and something we still feel confident we can move the needle on. So as things loosen back up over the next 3 to 5 years, I could see that price point going back up. But a big part of it right now, to answer your question, is just due to sourcing equity.
Yeah. And you have to put more money down, you know, nowadays than in years past. Interest rates are up and, you know, cap rates haven't followed suit 1-to-1 on it. So yeah, you're putting more money down today, and then the people are a little more hesitant to invest as well. Right. What we were talking about before. So yeah, double whammy in terms of just, I've heard that from like everybody, even the brokers joke about it. Like if you used to buy $20 million deals, you're calling me now saying, what do you got for $12 million? You know, and it's the same thing you're talking about, Dan.
Yeah. Yeah. And I like this market a lot, because I like that you don't have much debt. Like you're at 60 to 65% leverage, and the deals work. With, you know, we love Freddie Mac in the sense that we'll raise all of our equity, all of our CapEx as cash. And so we'll bring 30, 35% down, and we'll raise all of the CapEx as cash. So the leverage is super low. If you can be in a cash flow position, a cash on cash position with that, again, going back to why is now a great time? Another reason, you're seeing returns work with low debt. The only way you could make deals work back in late 2021, early 2022, was leveraging the deals to the max, like people did. You know, you got 85% leverage with 100% of the CapEx financed. So you're buying these deals with relatively very little money needed down, and everyone's jumping in because they're all doubling their money so quick. So you can see how that market just fed on itself. And so now it's the opposite of that, is you're buying with 60, 65, maybe 70% leverage max, raising all the CapEx, and folks are nervous because of what they're thinking about happened 2 years ago. So again, if you can buy now, that's another great reason to say, hey, very likely this deal is going to do well.
Yeah, it's definitely the way they're getting set up now is a lot less risky, just fundamentally. I mean, you never know what the future holds, but it, you know, it's, yeah, to your point, lower leverage, fixed rate. So starting off on a way better foot.
Love it. Love it.
What are you guys, who do you use for property management in these markets then?
Yeah, we use a variety of managers, and we have over the last few years. And what I'll say about property managers is that if someone's having success with a management company, it doesn't necessarily mean they're always going to be a great property management company. And I can tell you that because we've been with management companies that have been great, and then something changes internally at the company. They lose 3 or 4 A players And all of a sudden, now they're overwhelmed and the training isn't there and the leadership isn't there. And that management company you see at times goes under. So I'm a little hesitant to share some of the management companies we use, in the sense that if you have, and this happens sometimes with some rock group, unfortunately, is that once word gets around that a management company is doing good for two or three owners, now you've got maybe 40 or 50 owners who immediately go there. And a lot of times these management companies see dollar signs and they take on property after property, overwhelm themselves and go bust. And we've seen it real time with several management companies happen in Dallas. So I think the biggest piece to just know is that as the owner, you've got to know how to hire a great property management company, know what questions to ask, and be a great asset manager with that property manager, which means being a little delicate on how much demand you have, but yet getting your CapEx project done to meet pro forma rents. And your ability to do that will drastically dictate the performance of your assets, especially in this market.
And then what are some things that someone should be looking for then in a property manager, would you say?
Yeah, that's good stuff right there. So number one, when you're looking to hire your property management company, make sure that they specialize in the asset class you're buying. You know, is this management company A-class property management, or do they manage C-class properties in rough locations? Are they scattered management, or will they take on a property of your size? And then, you know, ask them to share some T12s, mark, cross off, block off, you know, some of the addresses and names and of the apartments, and share some financials. You know, like if you guys have done a great job for, you know, 6, 8 of your owners, 10 of your owners, show us T12s on a few of these units. And if they're not willing to do that, you just, you know, okay, how much does that mean to you? Or maybe they just don't share that information, or maybe they're hiding stuff. You gotta assess that. I'd ask them if they're willing to do weekly calls. You know, if they're okay and willing with you to show up at any time, or are they going to be upset if they're like, hey, you showed up and didn't tell us? You know, I'd ask and understand how long the team members, the key team members, have been at the company. I'd say one of the biggest things right now that we've seen that makes it challenging in this business is you're with a property management company and their internal staff, their employees are leaving, and you've got constant turnover. And so for the management companies that can maintain and keep great staff members for 10, 20, 30 years plus, I have more confidence and comfort in hiring that company versus you interview these people and you ask how long has your accountant been there? How long has this regional been there? How long has this on-site team been there? And it's been a year, 6 months, 12 months, 18 months. That's scary. Because turnover with this business is not good, because you want your property management company and regional manager and on site to know your property intimately. And you want them to know everything that's going on in these properties. And if there's turnover, and now you got a new regional, and then a new regional, and then a new on site, and it's just, they don't know what's going on. They're all in put the fire out mode versus let's plan and then execute mode.
Yeah. And there's no continuity, or just they don't know anything about the property. And yeah, those are all great points, Dan. So I think maybe switching gears a little bit, let's talk about passive investors. I know you have an ebook. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah. We have a 4 steps to successful passive investing. And it just goes through different things that we think anyone who's investing in real estate should know about. It is free. It's on our website. You just go to granitetowersequitygroup.com. And there's a contact us form, or I think it says even ebook, and I don't even know if we ask for your email or not, but, and if you don't want emails from us, we won't send them to you, but it's a free book just to educate, investors on things that they should be aware of. And, you know, if you want more content after that, you'll be able to reach out to us and we can provide more as well. But yeah, it's just the basics of what to watch out for, how to pick general partners, you know, it's the basics of real estate investing need to be understood. If you don't have the basics, it's easy for teams to pull wool over your eyes, and you got to be aware of that, and at all costs make sure you know what you're doing.
Yeah, no, that's really great advice. I mean, what is there a single most important thing or top couple things you think passive investors should be thinking about or know before they invest?
Yeah, there's two things that I would never bend on. And number one is, you know, like and trust your general partner, the person putting the deal together, well enough, whether you've met them several times or you've listened to their podcast or you've got a referral from a friend, that you can say with 97 to 98% certainty, this person is going to do the best they can. It doesn't mean necessarily that it's guaranteed that the deal is going to do well, but the person is ethical. I know them well enough. They've had success with other people where I know that they're going to do everything they possibly can to get the deal to perform well. That's number one. Number two is, you have to get to know a little bit, in my opinion, of their underwriting and the submarket they're buying in. And you have to be able to verify to a certain extent, or have them show you without any doubt what rents they're going to move to and what expenses they can achieve. And, you know, is their exit cap rate they're using, or is their refi play actually viable? And do you understand it well enough to be able to say, okay, yep, I can see based off of this submarket, based off of my little research, let's just say you take an hour. I mean, if you're going to put $60,000 to $100,000 into a deal, I think that warrants a few hours of work. And if you have a few hours to dig in, you can pretty quickly start to see if their underwriting is close or if it's just pie in the sky. And so I would do just a little bit of digging, and I would make sure that, again, you have that relationship with these folks. And you know, there's a lot of, unfortunately, a lot of people that are not good operators or ethical operators in this business. So it's easy to have a bad name.
Yeah. And I mean, I see that where I see deals get sent around and I look at it and I go like, this sale assumption is totally unrealistic. They'll never get it. And then they raise all the money, and then fast forward 5 years later and they can't sell the property, you know, for what they wanted. And then there's a change of plan where either they're selling it way below projections, or they're going to hold it longer to kind of hide, you know, what the reality is a little longer. But yeah, I see that time and time again, where assumptions are pushed. Some are, yeah, I think, you know, are maybe hard to verify as a passive investor, but some are really not. Like for an exit cap rate, like you see other deals either other sponsors or that have sold, and you can obtain that information. And rents, you can just go on Zillow and look at what similar buildings are renting for. Like the starting rents is one of the most important assumptions, like in the whole model. And property taxes. And property taxes, you could double check and say, hey, how are they arriving at this number? Because especially in a lot of these markets where they, you know, chase the sale and they move it up a lot, like that's really important to be dialed in on. So yeah, I think that's really, really solid advice, Dan.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, cool. Well, yeah, let's leave it there. I think, how can listeners get in touch with you?
Yeah, you bet. Just go to our website, granitetowersequitygroup.com, and there's a contact us button. Granite's just like the rock, towersequitygroup.com. And yeah, contact us and let us know how we can help. Hop on a call and see if we can add value to what you're doing with your investments long term.
Excellent. All right. Well, thanks, Dan. Appreciate you coming on.
Thanks, Drew, for having me. Appreciate your time.
If you learned something from today's show, leave a review and hit that subscribe button wherever you enjoy your podcasts. Dive deeper into real estate investing on Brenneman Capital's website, Brenneman.com, where we have numerous free resources and information that can help both active and passive real estate investors. Accredited investors can get started today as a passive investor in our multifamily investment opportunities by hitting the Invest Now button on our website.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of Drew Brenneman and guests as of the date of recording and do not purport to reflect the views or opinions of Brenneman Capital LLC and its subsidiaries. Views and opinions are provided for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon or deemed as investment or tax advice or an offer to buy or sell securities. The speaker cannot be held responsible for any direct or incidental loss incurred by applying any of the information offered.